I'm Nicole.
And I'm Brandon, and this is Spectrum Sessions,
where we talk about all things like diagnosis. We're also therapists who come at this with not only personal experience, but clinical experience as well. Welcome back to Spectrum Sessions. In today's episode, we're delving into a topic that is often overlooked, but incredibly important: neurodiversity and substance use. And I have a guest co-host today, Emily McDonald. She's a licensed professional counselor, and she was on our ADHD episode. Many autistic and ADHD individuals, as well as others in the neurodivergent community, face unique challenges when it comes to substance use, addiction, and recovery. We'll explore why neurodivergent folks may be more vulnerable to substance use, how masking, self-medication, and sensory overload play a role, and barriers that may impact accessing support. Whether you're neurodivergent yourself, supporting a loved one, a professional working in the field, or just curious, this episode aims to encourage understanding and insight into a complex but crucial topic. Let's dive in.
Thank you, Nicole. It's so great to be here again. I honestly didn't realize I was a co-host today. I thought I was just going to be a guest. I'm going up in the ranks, I guess, here.
Yes.
But this is an important topic and another one near and dear to my heart. So I feel very privileged to be here.
We did talk about on episode 4 how we were planning to do this episode, so we held true to our word.
Yes, you did, and I'm glad. I can't again commend you and Brandon more on what you're doing to help people, the neurodiverse community. So good work.
Let's talk about why neurodivergent individuals are at higher risk for substance use. So Emily is going to talk a little bit more about the ADHD side of it, and obviously I'm going to be interjecting with the autistic side of things.
Yes, and you'll realize, you know, if you remember from the episode that I was on, I am diagnosed with ADHD, and I also have a co-occurring substance use disorder in remission for a very, very long time. But so this again, like I said, is near and dear to my heart. And I know Nicole will be working on her side of neurodivergence for autism spectrum disorder. So you get two sides of the coin.
Both sides, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. And I think I just want to say, preface this too as well. I don't think many people know this about me, but I am sober myself. And so I figured that this would be a really important topic for me and Emily to delve into, and kind of why Brandon sat this one out, because we do have this, you know, personal experience that we can speak to.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess I'll start off talking on the ADHD side of things here. And let's start off with, you know, our young folks, our kiddos, about, you know, when and how this can start. It absolutely is more common for children with ADHD to start using and unfortunately abusing alcohol in their teen years than those who are not neurodivergent. So these numbers seem to even out when people reach their 20s because, of course, more people are drinking. They're more of age. So that does kind of peer out. However, people with ADHD at this point are actually more likely to excessively use alcohol, not just use, but excessively use. So, again, we're looking at more of the abusive, more binging forms of drinking. And links have been found between ADHD and other drugs, such as marijuana, other recreational drugs. So there, it correlates, the correlations are much higher for those with ADHD to engage in these types of risky behaviors than those who do not. So that being said, you can see how someone, as a young person, they are much more susceptible to these risky behaviors, including substance use. And of course, we're going to continue on as to why that is. So thinking about this and how it personally relates to myself, I started drinking at 11 years old, which is, I think now, wow, that's a baby. Yeah. And when you think about brain development and everything that goes with that. And when I say I started drinking, I mean, I started drinking to the point of blackout. It wasn't, yeah. I mean, it was kind of what you can get your hands on back then, but at the same time, it didn't take much because you were just starting out your drinking career, yeah. as I called it. And so it did start at a very young age, unfortunately for me. That progressed into marijuana use. So both I was using a lot of marijuana and drinking in my teen years. And so, yeah, and not and just thinking this is what everybody does. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to chalk it up and say, yeah, it was just the 80s. That was just the early 90s. But, you know, I can't use that as an excuse because there were definitely kids that weren't doing that. It. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. So,
yeah. Yeah. For me, I was like 12. So it's funny how similar in age we were. Mm-hmm. And I did start out with alcohol and then, you know, again, progressed to marijuana and then I progressed to other things. And I think for me, people are kind of surprised to know this information about me because for me, I went through this abuse when I was so young, right? Like, I think that people are shocked that I kind of had this whole alternate persona, and I kind of got it mm-hmm. out of the way before I even turned 21. So for me, I've been sober for almost a decade. And so I think it is just so sad as you grow older, right? Like, you realize, like, you were such a little human.
I know.
It's such a sad thing.
It's such a sad thing. I sometimes, you know, I know I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be, but if I could press the rewind button, sure. I would stick to my academics a lot more.
Sure.
I would have stuck to all those sports teams instead of dropping out and all the things that I could have done, and just living your childhood instead yeah. of thinking that it was always just a party and believe me, there I always say this, you know, there was definitely fun times. I'm not going to, but if you look at the expense of what I lost, and including my child, including my sense of self and what I was covering up, you know, I would say the negative consequences highly outweighed.
No way. Yeah. So as Emily just said, you know, using substances as a means to cover up. So I think that a lot of the reason and the root of the substance abuse is to, you know, mask. So Emily, can you share a little bit more about, you know, masking as a woman with ADHD and using substances to do so?
Sure. Well, I have to say, I think a lot of people mask. You know, I don't want to say this is just exclusive to the neurodivergent population. I want to say it's even more, even more so for women. You know, temper self. When you have a big personality like I do, I think for me it was always temper self and be a good girl and don't be too loud. And, and I always felt hyper and I had a loud volume and intense emotions. And so it was temper that, you know. and I guess alcohol, well, it certainly didn't temper that. Well, the weed did.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I don't know. I was really goofy on the weed, too. So I was just, I guess, always kind of loud. But I guess what it did do is I didn't care anymore.
Right.
That's,
exactly.
Yeah. That's what it was.
Yeah. And
right?
That's a commonality, too. You didn't care anymore. I think that's, you know, I can speak to my experience. I think that, you know, for me, the root cause was to lessen the social anxiety and uncertainty. I obviously am chronically anxious, chronically concerned about, you know, people's thoughts and expectations of me and, mm-hmm. you know, worried of saying the wrong thing.
Absolutely.
But when I was blacking out, obviously I didn't care. And neither did anybody else.
Oh, very true. And you found the people that didn't care right alongside you,
yeah.
you know? And so I think it has a lot to do with that anxiety.
Yes.
Like what was the masking created for? To reduce, you know, and anxieties, to
yeah,
feel
discomfort.
Like, yeah, yeah, the discomfort, to feel like you fit in. And I know for a fact I've always struggled as long as I can remember with this internalized anxiety. Whether it's just because my body was always so damn stimulated because I didn't, or maybe because I didn't produce the dopamine that others had. I don't, but it was always ever present. And and so a lot of that comparison was there and needing to be perfect. And I think we talked about this in that other episode too, Nicole, the
RSD,
which stands for
rejection sensitive disorder.
Yes, yeah, yeah, sensitive. I always, why do I want to put a different word in there? Rejection sensitive dysphoria, which you feel rejected. You feel rejected from society. You don't feel like you fit in. And that leaves you with an emptiness.
Yeah.
And a lot of times that emptiness, you know, leads to filling that void with something else, such as a substance. And I do have to say, and this is probably different from the ASD side, I would think, but as an individual with ADHD, I have a chronic boredom, which sometimes makes my whole body ache.
Sure.
I am chronically bored when you're drinking and partying and having fun. And that's what I called it. Always said it was one nonstop party, even if it was in a dirty, you know, seedy bar with just like a couple people.
Yeah.
To me, it was a party. I liked it like that. I liked it big. I liked it. So I think for me, it was just, I'm not alone. I'm with people. I'm, you know, out of myself. I'm, you know, it's a tonic and it's an elixir. It makes you not have to care. I mean, not have to feel. And so for me, it was twofold. I wasn't bored. Well, no, that's not true. I was. I was always like, what bar are we going to next? Where are we going to? We should get 12 packs for later. And when the bars close, where's late night going to be? So yeah, I think I was even bored partying to that degree. What else? Does anybody have anything else we could do? Yeah. So a lot of times that was easing that boredom. Yeah. So between the boredom and the quote unquote fitting in, and finding that crowd that, you know, was going to drink, those peers that were going to hang out and, you know, smoke weed with you. And so, you know, found them. And again, had some fun times, but at the expense of childhood, and a lot of negative consequences, unfortunately. And, you know, I always think of the whole fitting in thing. I think of Scranton. We are from Scranton, Pennsylvania, or the surrounding areas. And St. Patrick's Day around here is like Christmas.
Holiday.
Yeah. And I shouldn't say St. Patrick's Day itself, but the St. Patrick's Day parade day.
Yes.
Is very big for this, you know, moderate sized city. So it's huge. And if you, you know, are someone who likes to imbibe, it is a good day for you. And I have to say that was my favorite day of the year. Not because I got to drink. I drank all the time. It didn't really matter what the occasion. But because everybody else was drinking to the extent that I was. So I already drank excessively. I already did binge. I already did party loudly, you know, boisterously. Now everybody else was doing it too. So talk about not having to mask at all. That parade day was it. I never felt like I fit in more than on St. Patrick's Day parade day in Scranton. So I have to say, when I got sober, that was probably the hardest day out of, it was without a doubt the hardest day out of the year.
Yeah.
I would mourn it. Yeah. I would absolutely mourn it for the first couple years I did. So that's probably the best example I can give about fitting in.
For me, parade day resembled not feeling like I was under a microscope. I think that, you know, so much of my life I've been scrutinized for even just, you know, my facial expressions, right? So I think that for me, it was just a day where I just blended in and it felt good. It felt nice.
You molded, melded into the crowd
exactly.
Of nonsense.
Yes. but I think, you know, this goes into what we want to talk about next, which is burnout, right? So, you know, chronically feeling overwhelmed. And I think that this is a huge one for so many of us because we are so overstimulated all of the time.
All of the time.
It's so nice to not feel that, to just numb yourself and get rid of that burden. And I think that that is a huge contributing factor.
well, we're escaping, you know? Like, I mean, listen, it was fun. I mean, the drinking was like, you know, but it was the ultimate escape from my brain.
Yeah.
From the chronic thinking, from the chronic overstimulation, from the chronic worry, from, you know, that exhaustion of I can't handle executive functioning and fit in, you know? So it was just an escape from all of that.
Yeah. And it, you know, it wears you down. And we talked about how you just get such negative feedback growing up, you know, especially undiagnosed neurodivergent. And so it's kind of nice to remove yourself from that burden and that heaviness of feeling so rejected for your entire life. Now you found your people, your party people, mm-hmm. and you fit in and everything's fun and light and, you know, it's just, it's a different world.
Absolutely. It's a different world. So I concur completely, you know, and I always want to preface too, that the people that put us down the most were our own selves.
Yes.
Because we are the ones inside our little heads and internalizing, whether at that point in time, we were not necessarily conscious of it, but how much we were comparing ourselves to other people.
Yeah.
Because of how quote unquote different we felt. You know, and while we're talking about, you know, I mean, there's a million reasons. We can't get into all of them. And that's everybody else's, I think, personal journey, you know, in recovery or sobriety. But if we're talking about, you know, reasoning behind, you know, use for specifically, I'm going to talk about ADHD, but the impulse control, especially when you're younger and you're, you know, I mean, our frontal lobes have issues anyway, but that, you know, the idea that, you know, there's impaired communication going on between different regions of the brain that contribute to inattention and emotional dysregulation and impulsivity for someone with ADHD. So, you know, if you think about that, you're definitely more susceptible to risk-taking behaviors and you don't have the foresight. You don't have the foresight of your actions of, oh, this could lead to negative consequences. Yes. Now, I know that sounds like any teenager under the sun, but when it starts going into your 20s and into your, you know, early 30s, then, you know, you have to really look at that. So definitely, I would think potentially compared to those who are not neurodivergent, looking at that impulse control and that lack of the correlation between, you know, oh, this could be a negative consequence. This could have a not great outcome. And just bypassing that and going right into the action of, I'll try that. Sure, give it to me. What is it? Is it going to make me escape? Okay. You know, so.
Yeah, and there's, you know, so much overlap in, you know, autism and ADHD and substance use. But I think our issue is more so rooted in, you know, the social aspect or, you know, sensory mm-hmm. overload. So I think that that's really where, you know, the paths diverge between the two.
And think about that. You know, you and I, even though we drank for the same reasons, we drank for the different reasons.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't really have to worry about, although that's not true. I could definitely say the overstimulation at times, but maybe not. I still liked talking to people. I still liked being around people. Smaller groups, I would say, but I don't think the sensory overload was probably different. Let's put it that way. You know, the social anxieties were probably a lot different.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know, still using it as a way to cope with the symptoms.
Yeah. And I think for me, like I, you know, looking back, I obviously would hang out in groups. I would, you know, I, by nature, am not a group type of person. I get very overwhelmed if it's just even more than two people that I'm sitting with. So I think for me, in order to socialize, right, have a social life as a teen, you know, like most teens want, I had to be obliterated to a certain degree. So, again, I think it is, you know, just such a different reasoning, but there is still so much overlap as well.
Yeah. And, you know, the one thing I think that, you know, Nicole and I had talked about was the lack of research for, yes. yeah, for, you know, for ASD. So with substance, SUD.
Yeah. Even, you know, trying to put this podcast episode together, I was sitting there and trying to research, and, you know, the research is so conflicting. It either says that autistic folks are, you know, more likely to engage in unhealthy drinking, or they're less likely. And there's really not even much recent research. I think it's only within the past decade mm-hmm. or so that it's been sort of kind of looked at. And again, it's nothing concrete. It's nothing formal. And I was reading that, and I believe this too, I think that one of the reasons is like just the negative stigma that is associated. I think that autistic people, well, first of all, I think that, you know, it's a myth perpetuated that autistic adults don't exist or autistic adults don't have issues. And I think that it's another myth that autistic people are, you know, innocent and, you know, whatever.
Shy,
yeah,
reclusive.
Innocent, shy, yeah. reclusive. Yeah, yeah. And would never engage in this type of thing.
Well, but, well, and that's funny because the research, at least what is out there, what I could find, I mean, there's tons on ADHD, let's put it that way. And again, look at the differences in the, maybe in the personality types, like Nicole was just saying, you know, an ADHD person, like we're talking binging, excessive, extreme ingestion of substances, as opposed to, it seems like the research that was out there, with individuals with ASD, potentially engaging, it's still problematic, but it's a more controlled, more functional type of drinking per se. So that can fall under the radar too, for sure. As opposed to, okay, I'm not, you know, chugging 12 beers, you know, and then, you know, passing out in front of everybody and, you know, peeing my pants. It's instead I'm drinking, you know, a couple Manhattans at home at night, every single night in order to cope. Mm-hmm. But still feeling the hangover, still not eating right, still not, you know. And so, I mean, that's assumptive, but, you know, and that's what I'm kind of, you know, getting maybe more from the context.
There's somebody who I just want to share as like a resource for people who might be listening. So there was somebody who was on The Bachelor. Her name is Demi, and she was recently diagnosed with autism, and she is now sober. And she was talking about her experience on The Bachelor and excessively drinking just mm-hmm. to kind of get through that experience and kind of really get through it her entire life. So again, I think that, I don't know. It's just such a different context. I think it's just, again, stemming from the social differences. And I think that it can be overlooked, right? Because we're mm-hmm. not always in social situations.
Correct.
So that can make it really difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Again, you know, and again, not to generalize, but, you know, if you're not the social person starting fights
right
and being rowdy, you know, potentially, you know, are people really going to pay attention as much?
Exactly.
Is it, you know, so maybe the drinking does look different, and again, hoping that the research finally can come out with some of these differences and what that looks like for individuals with ASD.
So I have a quote here by Dr. Devin Price. I know on this podcast I seem like I'm immortalizing them, and I kind of am because I love them, but they have a quote: in order to get sober, sometimes you have to be willing to be more autistic. I thought that was very telling and relatable. I think for me, I didn't necessarily know like the degree to which I'm autistic until I became sober, because I don't know, you just blur so much of mm-hmm. things together. It's kind of muddy and you don't know what the hell is what. And so I think for me, again, when I engaged in substance use, it was to kind of just put myself into shape myself into something I wasn't necessarily at heart. And I think now that I've been sober, I have a lot better boundaries and like expectations, and I don't force myself into situations that aren't authentic. And, you know, we're going to be talking more about authenticity and what that looks like for us, because I do think that when you give up substance use, I think that you do find your more authentic self. And I think that you get to really see who you are without covering it up.
I could not agree more. That is so relatable. You know, and I think that's someone I have worked in DNA and drug and alcohol in the past. And, you know, this topic will come up again. We were talking about schools of thought, and there's different schools of thought, of course, but the idea that can you work on mental health? Can you work on other issues if you're not sober, if you're not, you know, in some type of, you know, recovery, if you're not abstaining or at least controlling your use? Because where's the clarity then?
Yeah.
You know, it fogs it up. It blocks the emotion. It allows for the continued escape, everything that deviates from your true self. So that would make sense. I can relate just as far as the, you know, ADHD being so what people would think extroverted, gregarious, big, again, a lot, whatever you want to call it. But not until I got sober, and I would say even after quite a few years of being sober, did I realize how much I was just seeking calm and quiet and peace. And actually, if you can kind of go rewind into my childhood, that's all I did. I was very quiet. I read. It was my hyper-focus. I just read and read and read for hours and hours and on end. And it doesn't mean I still wasn't hyperactive. It doesn't mean I still wasn't outgoing. It doesn't mean but I was apparently coping and finding peace in those ways. And I, not until I got sober, was able to kind of return to that and realize that is such a huge piece of my authentic self too. You know, not to, but I always trivialize these terms, but, you know, I do feel like I'm an extroverted introvert. You know, yeah. I do feel like I can be bubbly and happy, and I feel that constantly because I feel so much, but I just always want calm and stillness within me. And, you know, searching for that in substances, and now I can do it in healthy and productive ways. So yeah, I mean, I get that in that way. I don't know if getting sober has helped me become more ADHD, but what I do think it's helped me become more of my authentic self for sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, as far as being your authentic self, how do you find that person? I think being a therapist, everybody's always trying to find their authentic self. I really do think that's the cusp of a lot of existential issues and so forth, but I digress. We won't get into that. But as far as this particular topic, there's tons of alternatives to regulating sensory and emotional needs, exploring healthier coping strategies, and replacing, you know, negative thinking, whatever it might be, formulating your own individualized treatment, whether it's you doing that for yourself, you doing that with help. But there are lots of ways, I think, to engage in other things, productive things, healthy things outside, of course, substance use. I don't mean to make that seem so easy, because as someone who has, I would say, struggled for like a year and a half, not maintaining sobriety, but wanting to be sober, that was the difficult part. I really, really had intensive cravings, which I guess I could talk about. I know I just switched gears pretty quick, but I swear it'll connect. So when we're talking about cravings, those with ADHD brains, we don't produce as much dopamine as individuals who do not have ADHD. So seeking out that dopamine, there's a need. There's, I want this replaced. Whether, again, you know, we don't know that, but biologically we know it. Mm-hmm. And so you're craving that. You're craving that dopamine. And then once you find that dopamine in other ways, good, bad, and different, you know, you want more of it. You know, once you feel it, once you feel, oh, this feels good, you kind of solidify a psychological and a physiological need, because your body actually does need it physiologically, and your brain now is craving it psychologically. So this creates that habituation. And again, this could be good, bad, and different. I'm going to explain why. So you seek out that feeling again and again and again. And of course, this could be the cycle of problematic substance use. And so, or if you want to create dopamine in other ways, which is what I do now, exercise, yoga, meditation, these are my dailies. And this increases dopamine and serotonin, as well as GABA, the neurotransmitter that creates calmness. So all these chemicals, these are chemicals, I don't know, about the, I definitely know the dopamine, but the, these are in ADHD meds. Mm-hmm. You know, these are what work for individuals. So there's a lot, and there's a lot, there are is actually a lot of research in these forms of, you know, coping. Exercise, yoga, meditation, formulating healthy activities. I talked about the hyper-focus before. Reading is one for me. Gardening, crafting, whatever you do. The importance of, you know, nutrition. I'm also big on that. You know, there's a whole, I mean, I have to say, if you look out there, yes, there are definitely different diets for different symptoms and different diagnoses, but they all surround the same kind of stuff, you know? And so an ADHD diet, same as most, you know, stay away from dyes, additives. Yeah. There are allergy, you know, warnings on things too, but it's the same type of, you will see for the most part, a mainstream diet that is healthy and nutritious.
Yeah. And I think, you know, anybody needs to stay away from the additives.
Agreed.
And the dyes, right? And I think that too, a lot of autistic folks have, you know, overlapping physical conditions as well, which, you know, impacts what we, you know, can or cannot put mm-hmm. into our bodies as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, taking into mind all of those things, this is kind of the holistic approach here of,
yeah.
you know, all encompassing of what can help. Of course, then we go into the therapy part of it.
Yes.
That is great for emotional needs, exploring yourself, finding your authentic self. I know, as a therapist, I prefer acceptance and commitment therapy, mindfulness-based stress reduction, forms of DBT, because I think they reduce that internal and external judgment.
Yeah.
So it reduces all the fear of external judgment of, oh, everybody's, you know, looking at me, everybody's judging me. It reduces that, and it also reduces your own internal judgment of, oh, I'm not good enough, and it reduces your judgment of others so that you gain a little more acceptance of like, well, everybody's got stuff. So, you know,
yeah.
I can't think that they're this horrible person. And that makes your world a little safer too, for sure. It helps you stay present and focus, these types of therapies. As well as for me, this is a big one. It reduces attachment to emotions. It brings you into this wiser mind state of being where you're not overthinking, but you're not overly attached to an emotion either. And it's not bypassing feeling per se. It's just the emotions feel so much and so big. And sometimes, you know, okay, I'll have a drink and get rid of this emotion. Or I can help reduce that emotion to a more regulated state by not attaching so much to it, identifying, over-identifying with it. And that is why I know Nicole and I know she uses acceptance and commitment therapy a lot too. That's why it's big for me.
Yeah, and, you know, we also talk about the benefits of CBT as well, and Emily and I were talking a little bit off the podcast about how it hasn't necessarily worked personally for either one of us.
No.
And we were trying to, like, figure out, like, the why behind that. And unfortunately, again, you know, at this point in time in 2024, there's just not enough research about, you know, benefits to evidence-based treatments in autistic folks. And I think that that's going to change, and I am excited for that. But I think where we're at now, there's just not enough information. And like Brandon and I talked about in a previous episode, we talked about modifying CBT, right? And I truly do think that pretty much every therapy modality does need to be modified to some capacity when you're working with autistic folks. And I think that, you know, what works for one autistic person isn't going to work for another autistic person. So again, you know, as therapists, I think we have to be very mindful of being super individualized with each person.
Yeah, I think that's what it all comes down to. Yeah. You know, you can sit here and say you have 10 therapists in a room, everyone's going to have different modalities they prefer. And, you know, and a lot of them they do prefer because it's something that works for them. But of course you have to take into consideration the client sitting across from you and what works specifically for that individual.
Yeah.
I have to talk about positive psych.
Of course.
Motivational interview. Because, you know, like here's where I don't like to focus on the problem. Maybe that's another thing. Maybe that's why I don't use CBT as often, or at least straight out CBT, because we all mush everything together, really.
Yeah.
But I believe in empowering people, strength-based strategies. These are huge for me. So I don't, even though you don't bypass the problem, and there is a lot of time spent on that, you know, especially in the beginning, but really looking at the strength-based piece of these. So even though Nicole and I so far have talked about some downer stuff, you know, there's a lot of hope here too.
Yeah.
There's a lot of hope. And I think that, you know, instilling that in people through these types of modalities, positive psych, motivational interviewing, empowering through choice, that's a little bit of reality therapy right there. But, you know, these strength-based strategies. And I think in our other episode that I was in, I talked about Dr. Halliwell and how he is working on even changing ADHD, attention hyperactivity, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So I told you those two D's, I'm not thrilled with the deficit and the disorder. Yeah. And he's looking into calling it VAST, which stands for Variable Attention Stimulus Trait. Looking at it as these are stimulus traits, these are, you know, and so, you know, I sound like I actually am talking about CBT because I'm talking about reframing wording and how important that is. And it is, it really is.
It is.
But, you know, using this in an empowered approach, and maybe for me not focusing on that this is maladaptive thinking.
Right.
Or, I mean, that's kind of a little bit of old school, but, you know, this is just the way you think. It's not wrong, but is it productive or healthy for
you?
Right. You know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So going along with, you know, like Emily said, we've been kind of downers for this episode. But going along with, you know, the more positive aspects, I think, you know, a common thread for Emily and I, you know, and why we use substances was the social aspect,
right? Absolutely.
So I think that building, you know, social connections without relying on substances is super important and something that you have to, you know, grow through. And I think, like we talked about earlier, becoming more authentic is really at the root of that. I think that when you allow yourself to unmask and accept your diagnosis and accept that you're different, and that doesn't need to change. You don't need to make yourself, you know, inebriate it to be liked. I think that it's so important to feel safe around people. I was telling Emily that, you know, since I got my diagnosis, I'm coming to realize that my body does such a good job at telling me who is good for my nervous system and who is not, and really honoring that and having, you know, just very supportive and understanding people in your life. Mm-hmm. And finding your community. I think that's so huge. And I think, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be an in-person community. I think online communities as well are amazing for, you know, late diagnosed ADHD and autistic folks. But just having that ability to be your truest self is so important in, you know, continuing your sobriety.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. And you're right. I mean, we all need supports and people that are like-minded, like us, and that we feel comfortable around and safe around, that's super important. I often tell clients, I don't know if I've ever used the metaphor, the theater metaphor.
No.
I didn't use it in law. Okay. Mm-mm. I, you know, as therapists, we tend to repeat ourselves. I do anyway. And of course I have ADHD, so I can't remember if I did or not. So, so there's that. But I always say, you know, look at the theater. Who's in your front row? You need those people in your front row.
Yeah.
And then you might have some people that are, you know, a little farther back. Some people maybe in the balcony, the mezzanine. And then you know those people that you don't even want. You're not even giving them a ticket. Yeah. You're not even getting a ticket into this theater, you know. So you have to assess that for yourself. And I think when you're drinking, you know, you align with like equals like. So you're surrounded by people drinking. I don't know about you, but I remember thinking how many times – well, everybody drinks.
Yeah.
Everybody. And then you get into the world and yeah, people drink, but
not like you.
not like that. And actually some people don't drink.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, you definitely, the more authentic you are, the more you gravitate towards those people. I mean, look at Nicole and I. We have certainly gravitated towards each other over the years, yes, for sure. So you can assess those healthy boundaries for yourself. That's what I'm hearing from Nicole for sure.
So we talked about, you know, types of treatment modalities, but I do want to focus on, you know, recovery-based practices specifically, and how it's different. And the approach needs to be a little bit different for folks that are neurodivergent compared to, you know, the general population. And so, you know, something like the 12-step model, I think, can be a little hairy for neurodivergent folks. And I'm going to let Emily talk a little bit about, you know, some of the barriers that we might face in getting appropriate treatment for substance use.
Well, sure. Barriers, you know, I think whenever you're dealing with any type of a mental health disorder, any type of co-occurring, any type of dual diagnosis, yes, there are definitely lots of facilities out there that have co-occurring, have dual diagnosis, but where does that fall as far as neurodivergence? Maybe ADHD. Exactly. I've definitely seen ADHD, but I'm sorry again. Now we're looking at the side of ASD that is just non-existent. Yep. It just really isn't out there. So, and then I get back into, you know, old school DNA that is ingrained in my brain too of, you know, is that necessary? Is that necessary? Because the, you know, the school of thought there is, well, you go in and you get treatment for your substance use disorder. But then the other school of thought is, well, how can you get treatment for your substance use disorder if the main reason you're using a substance is because of your autism spectrum disorder or your ADHD or your whatever it might be. So how does that look as far as, you know, so I guess when looking for an actual treatment facility, really doing your research and see what's out there. Hopefully you're, you know, and thinking of this as a good thing.
Yeah.
That, you know, you're seeking treatment and, you know, wanting to get help for yourself. But yes, is there a lack of treatment for those that are duly diagnosed with neurodivergence? Without a doubt. And going back to the 12-step model, well, you know, maybe I'll get crap for this, but it's definitely antiquated. The book has not, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous has not changed, with reason too. There's beliefs there. And, you know, I even know with my clients, a lot of them struggle, those that are atheists or agnostic and, you know, confirmed with that, you know, they struggle with the higher power concept. And there's a lot of ways around that too. And I'm not going to get into any type of debate with that because I did and do believe in the 12 steps tremendously and as a program and as a fellowship. And I think it can be great. But where I see the drawback for those with neurodivergence, well, and especially ASD, you know, we're looking at the group setting. Nicole can talk about that. I mean, sitting in a group and talking and, you know, or even if you don't talk or choose to talk, what about just raising your hand or having, if it goes around and it comes to you saying, you know, hi, my name is Emily, I'm an alcoholic. You know, if you have ASD, is that going to be, that is, you're probably going to be
shitting bricks.
Absolutely. What about a lot of the places? It's a, you know, a church basement with bright lights all over the place. And maybe there's 100 people.
Chatter.
That's a lot for everybody. So I mean, that's probably stuff again you could probably talk about more. There's always challenges. There's definitely more recovery type programming out there. There's smart programming. There's a lot of different types of outpatient facilities with different types of programming. A lot of them are using, you know, theoretical models, CBT included. So yes, there's definitely different things out there. But are those things out there for ASD or even ADHD? Well, yeah, not so much right now. So just summing things up here, I think that, you know, really getting the message across that, you know, the predisposition to have a diagnosis of neurodivergence and realizing there is a correlation without a doubt. Yes, a lot more research for ASD, but the ADHD correlation is so high, even genetically. The genetics between ADHD and alcoholism exist. And so, you know, being mindful of this moving forward, and I can't thank Nicole and Brandon enough because, you know, with the little research that there is with with ASD and substance use disorder, you know, hopefully things like them doing this podcast will, you know, open people's minds, foster advocacy, research, and really give people hope. So I can't thank you enough for having me on here again to talk about this and share my experience both personally and professionally.
Of course. It's always a blast. Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Spectrum Sessions. We hope today's conversation on neurodivergence and substance use has shed light on the unique challenges and experiences within the neurodivergent community. Understanding these connections is crucial to creating more compassionate and inclusive support. If this episode resonated with you, we'd love to hear your thoughts, experiences, or questions. Please subscribe and be sure to share with anyone who might find this episode helpful. As always, stay kind and stay curious.